Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Indeed. And this is number 60.
Wow.
60.
Oh, I'm impressed.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about iRobot, the movie, the 2004 movie, starring Will Smith and directed by Alex Proyas. Hope I pronounced that right.
I have no idea.
Proyas. Yeah. He's directed some interesting stuff.
Oh, yes.
Dark City. Have you ever seen that one?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh, but that's a terrific movie.
Heard it praised many a time and then been told I shouldn't watch it by my daughters.
Huh, interesting. Okay. How about Knowing with Nicolas Cage?
Mm-mm.
Okay. The Crow, about 1994.
Heard of it, not seen it.
Yeah.
Supposed to be good.
And it looks like he's got The Unpleasant Profession of Jonathan Hoag in production.
I've heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what it is.
That is a Heinlein novel.
That's why I've heard of it, I guess. Yeah.
It says, a man who suddenly realizes that he has no memory of what he does during the day hires a husband and wife detective agency to follow him. The truth takes a dark turn as their investigation leads to a series of frightening revelations.
Oh.
There's your description. It doesn't say who's in it or anything like that. IMDb.
Now, have you read that book?
I have not. Huh.
Okay.
I haven't read a lot of Heinlein.
I've read some.
Yeah, I've read maybe three or four.
The juveniles I prefer to the adult novels.
Mm-hmm.
But I have read iRobot many a time,
although
not recently
so
at all. And I'll just say right now, kind of the way Rose said it when we saw The Count of Monte Cristo, and she stood up, and we looked at her because she's the only one who'd read the book, and she goes, the book, the movie, the sandwich, I love them all. They're all very different. And that's kind of my philosophy with this movie. Very different.
Yeah.
But still worth enjoying.
It is. It's an enjoyable movie in my opinion. And it's what I like and dislike about Hollywood all in the same movie.
Wow, yeah. Did they manage to do that so well, I have to say. Will Smith jumping on a motorcycle while shooting with both hands at a bunch of robots, that was a macho, adrenaline-filled moment that belongs to an American summer. I was like, oh, yeah, shoot him up.
Oh, heck yeah.
Save Shia LaBeouf. That's how you say his name.
Yep, he's got some Terminators to fight later in his career.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I kept going. Somehow this is like a Terminator movie, but not quite.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And it's interesting how they put that. You know, we mentioned iRobot, the book, which is written by Isaac Asimov, who is an atheist. Was an atheist, I guess, I should say.
Yes, I forgot that. One wonders what he would have thought of the twist that is below all this stuff in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. And the book is a collection of short stories. Mm-hmm. So, in the book, there's no police officer character trying to solve this crime. And that's what the movie is Will Smith plays a police officer in the future who is trying to solve a murder of a robot scientist.
Well, and it's kind of interesting, though. One wonders if they had actually read The Caves of Steel at all.
Yeah, and that's an interesting, too, yeah.
Murder mystery, although it's, of course, very different from this. But there are some elements that are similar, I thought. For instance, the detective hates robots.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And in Isaac Asimov's, by the time the short stories end in the book and The Caves of Steel begin, robots look more and more and more human, so it can be difficult to tell them from humans.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things this guy hates. But actually, you know, watching this movie for the second time, I was struck by a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One is that it was not quite as clever as I thought when I saw it the first time. Some of the dialogue, I was like, oh, really? You're just going to say that and think it's clever. Got it. But the other thing was that they actually, I thought, did not do a bad job of translating Asimov's three robotic laws into a story that showed the way the laws play against each other.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that was the subject of almost all of Asimov's robot stories. That was the subject. You have these three laws, and they're supposed to be hardwired into these robots. And then the mystery stories, which all the stories, the robot stories are mysteries, are someone trying to figure out, well, why is a robot doing this, or how is it possible that this robot could lie, for example?
Well, they're all mysteries. I mean, the two I remember the most are the little girl who had the big, giant Robbie the robot.
Oh, yeah, that's Robbie. Yeah,
and
the first story.
And he gets taken away because, you know, and she, I mean, that wasn't a mystery. And then the one about the guy who had the robot wife, Helen.
Mm-hmm.
And as he gets older, he forgets that she's a robot. And so they start making her hair grow gray. And, I mean, that was a love story. A lot of
them
are mysteries.
I don't recall. That one I don't recall.
Oh, yeah. It's funny that those are the two I recall off the top of my head.
Yeah, the ones that I remember are ones with Susan Calvin. And Susan Calvin in the stories is a robo-psychologist. Right. So she's called in whenever a robot misbehaves. And
I forgot that.
Yeah, so she comes in and solves these mysteries. And that's what I remember out of those stories.
I know I should have reread these. Oh, well.
Yeah, in an iRobot, I think...
She's in the movie.
Yeah, Susan...
Made to look scientific by not putting as much makeup on her as they should, pulling her hair back.
Oh, that's
that
funny. It's funny that you should say that, because...
Yeah.
Harlan Ellison wrote a script for iRobot. It's kind of a famous science fiction story. When Isaac Asimov was still alive, Harlan Ellison wrote this script, and he published it later because it was never going to be made into a movie. So I've got
it with so many of his scripts.
So I've got it right here. So yeah, the story of how it didn't get made. You know, people don't like working with Harlan Ellison very much often.
Yeah.
But anyway, he wrote this script, and it's the reason that it kind of triggered in me, because I flipped through it again yesterday, and it makes a point of, you know, Susan Calvin is plain looking. He seems to make a very, you know, he just flipping through here, see if I can find it. Let's see. Yeah, I don't know. It's gonna waste too much time to try and find it. But he made in the script, he made a very pointed reference that she is plain looking. Underline. You know, took several sentences. Yeah. So anyway, so it's funny that you say, you know, so Bridget Moynihan, who's gorgeous, you know, they just give her less makeup and now she's a scientist. It's funny.
I know, she always looked a little tired and haggard, and I was like, oh, right, they haven't given her all the makeup they should, and her hair is usually pulled way back, and she's wearing a very severe scientific-looking coat, usually, or jacket. And
sure.
You know.
I was relieved that it didn't turn into a love story.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there was some googly eyes at the end, but
well,
that
was just pure friendship and love, you know, that kind of love. Well, yeah, it's the, I was also watching going, oh, right, I've read somewhere that Will Smith is the only black man in America who could have had a romance with her. And everybody would have gone, oh, Will Smith, come on. Everybody loves him.
Oh, man, yeah.
You know,
it's interesting to me, you know, I said, you know, I both love, I mean, this is an example of what I both love and dislike about Hollywood. They missed a huge opportunity here, because one of the most famous female characters in science fiction is Susan Calvin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they gave her a backseat in this movie.
She was kind of a sidekick.
She was kind of a sidekick, and she's the lead character in most of those iRobot stories. If I remember right, I think the first story is Robbie, and then there's a story about... some robots on a different planet that,
see, I don't remember.
And there was some kind of a problem with one of the robots. And then I think from then on, all of them have Susan Calvin in it. There's only like seven stories in the book. So,
yeah. And this, she's the brain in that she provides the background scientific information and says things like, that's where the core is. That's where you have to inject the nanites. But other than that, I mean, he has to come in and through a window dramatically shooting up a robot with a lot of guns to save her, whereas Susan Calvin would have found some clever way to just tell that N5 to stand down just through using logic.
Yeah.
Or, you know, sneaking up behind it somehow with a screwdriver or whatever they used.
Right.
A sonic screwdriver like Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah, there was one scene where there's a robot in here named Sonny who has kind of gone off on his own. He's not acting like all the other robots do. So she's interviewing him, and that was a window into those stories. It's interesting, you know, they didn't say this is based on Asimov's stories. It just says suggested by the book by Isaac Asimov. I thought that was interesting, you know. Often they, you know, Hollywood will buy a book and, what book? I remember Patriot Games by Tom Clancy. I read the book right before I saw the movie, and I saw it in the theater. And then I came out of there and I was like, you know, I don't think there's a single scene in that movie that was in the book. It was like the same kind of a feel.
I also read that book.
Yeah, it just wasn't the same thing, you know?
Yeah,
so it was like they bought the name and then made their own movie. Which is, you know, why do they do that? So, you know, I'm glad they didn't say based on. They just kind of said, well, it was suggested by. And it's an interesting statement that, you know, Harlan Ellison, and I understand the personality and how people, you know, have trouble with him personally. Mm-hmm. But you read this screenplay, and it's pretty darn smart. It would have been
a great movie.
Really interesting movie. Yeah. I mean, would it have been a summer blockbuster? I doubt it, because the interest is probably limited.
Right. And he's about the art, not about the box office. Well, and Tom saw something. Mm-hmm. He read an interesting talk that Steven Soderbergh gave at some, like, a San Francisco Film Festival this spring. And luckily he just told me the high points, but the essence of it was that they have found they have to spend so much in marketing. And he questioned whether they actually had to do that, especially for movies with well-known stars or big name franchises, but they can make their money back more easily somehow if they just throw tons and tons of money into it than if they make a small, smart indie type movie.
Yeah.
Studios are weird. I don't get it.
And, you know, I believe that. And, you know, Star Trek is a really good example. You saw Star Trek yesterday.
I did.
Yeah, and it's kind of an example of that. And, you know, I gave Star Trek 3 stars. And I feel like, you know,
I'm getting
pretty grumpy.
We gave it 3.5, mostly because we saw iRobot. And I was like, I can't say they're the same.
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Interrupting.
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, the original Star Trek show, would they have like 80 episodes or something like that?
Yeah.
I'm going to guess that maybe 30 of them were really smart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were interesting. A lot of science fiction authors actually wrote scripts for that show. You know, they weren't just, you know, I say just TV writers as if that's not a thing. You know, TV writers can be very smart. But I'm just saying that they were taking science fiction writers of the time and inviting them to write these scripts. So there was a lot of, you know, Theodore Sturgeon and Harlan Ellison wrote one. And
see who these are.
Norman Spinrad, I think, wrote one too.
Yeah.
So anyway, there was some really smart stuff that was going on in there. And then we had The Next Generation years later. And there was some really smart shows in that too.
Mm-hmm.
And then Deep Space Nine was a totally different kind of thing. You know, there wasn't, it wasn't a whole lot of science fiction, really. It was kind of a science fiction setting. And they were talking about religion and religious persecution and all that kind of stuff in that show.
Yeah.
But then Voyager was pretty much void of science. And there was a Star Trek writer who said that they used to just, if they were writing a script, they would just leave a gap. and say, okay, we need some scientific reason here for this me to get here. And then they'd hand it to some department who would say, well, the tachyon surge is on the port side. And I mean, they would just make stuff up at that point. And then now we're in the movie. You know, the two new movies, you know, Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness, those are kind of like iRobot, meaning it's like they're using the Star Trek setting for this action packed movie. And what I didn't like about the new Star Trek movie was that it had a lot of dumb things in it. it was entertaining as heck, and it was kind of neat to see all the things that they did playing with the old show. Right. But at the same time, you know, is it so much to ask that it be kind of smart as well?
Yeah.
And I don't think it's too much.
I have to say, when I was sitting there going, about the fifth time, and I don't really watch movies and sit and think about them that much, especially this kind of movie. I'm just like, yo, look, Bones said this. Isn't that funny? and the banter and et cetera and the adventure. But when about the fifth time I'm several minutes ahead of it happening going, oh, this is how this is going to get fixed. Oh, that's how that's going to get fixed. Oh, here's what they're going to do there. Oh, here's what they're going to do here. I'm like, you know, I can't really do that always with Doctor Who, which we're now just watching season two of. Mm-hmm. I'm like, could I just get something where if I could do it this many times, wow, that's lazy plotting. Okay.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just me, but.
No, and then that's how I felt about it too. You know, lazy plotting, it was like, okay, we need to get to Kronos, so let's do this.
Yeah.
And then let's show these people some Klingons for no reason. And then let's, you know, that's just kind of how the whole thing felt.
Yeah, although, don't get me wrong, everybody, I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
It was worth my entertainment dollar.
Yeah.
I felt.
And that's exactly what I said, too. It's very entertaining.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
It's worth seeing some of that stuff, yeah.
Yes, possibly the coolest looking villain ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
With apologies to Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah.
He was probably cooler looking, but in a different way. But, you know, most of the... He wasn't... I don't know. He had a duster on. It's a thing, right? For now, he looked good.
Right.
But back to iRobot.
Order duster. That's on my list.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... Get a duster, and you're going to just look 1,000 times better. All Thank right. you, Firefly, for making that a thing.
Heck yeah. Yeah, so then we have iRobot. And then, you know, iRobot is made from, I mean, the source material are these really smart stories.
Right.
You know, there's argument about, you know, whether it's science fiction or not, but, you know, we had a conversation with Eric Rabkin over on SFF Audio, and he called Asimov's robot stories fairy tales. And for an explanation on that, I'll put a link to that. It's very interesting to hear him talk about it. Anyway, they're very smart stories, and it's interesting that in order for this to get made, you know, it had been attempted to get made for a long, long time, and in order for it to get made, it was turned into an action film, you know?
Well, yeah, because Will Smith was one of the executive producers, and he's probably like, here's what people like to see me in, or that's what somebody else was doing, because I kept watching it thinking of Pursuit of Happiness, where he showed he could do a lot more.
Yeah.
And it was a smaller movie, but a lot of people still saw it because it's Will Smith, everybody. Mm-hmm.
By the way,
thank you for that opening scene with Will Smith. I was sitting there going, thank you, Scott. I probably would have watched this movie again and I would have missed so much.
Yeah, you probably should have rewound it at that point and
taken another look
just to make sure you didn't miss anything.
Yeah, well, there's some subtext there, right? Will Smith managed to take his shirt off about as many times as Captain Kirk on Star Trek. So, but I did want to say, I thought it was kind of interesting watching it and he turns on superstition and that kind of sets the theme for the whole movie. They did do a few things where I was like, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't noticed that, but he's playing superstition. He's getting dressed. They're having the, you know, faraway shower scene. I'm like, whoa, okay. And, that's everybody is thinking about when you do things you don't understand. Mm-hmm. That's superstition. You know, that's kind of, that's the theme of the song. And he's going based on completely on feelings, not on logic.
Yeah.
There's something wrong about the experience he had a long time ago with a robot that he knows it wasn't right, but he can't base it on any kind of logic. And everybody else is defending robots and robotics and any choice they make based on the fact that their brains can work faster, the logic is there, that's got to be superior. And so the whole movie winds up making an argument, actually, that you can't be human without emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of interesting because I was thinking about that in terms of the other strand of Sonny, the robot who's named Sonny, and he was created differently. He's like the next generation of robot. And he says things like, I believe my father made me for a purpose. And he's unique. And he's a robot that can consider for himself, what choices does he make? How are they logical? What should he do? And he's still not violating his prime directives, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he has. Yeah, and it's interesting that he is one that has the ability to supersede those three laws.
But with that superseded understanding comes a better understanding of the three laws of robotics, whereas if everybody hasn't seen it, they've tuned out by now, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. What's her name? The Vicky, the main robot, has just a very one-dimensional look at those laws without any emotion and any deeper understanding. It's pure logic. And she takes it to an extreme level that doesn't understand people or anything about living. And I was like, wow, that's an interesting idea. That's, to me, if we're going to extrapolate, and of course I am, that's like looking from the outside at religion and going, well, logically speaking, these laws were made by people for this and it doesn't make any sense and blah, 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 like a lot of atheists will do.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lot of people from other religions who don't stop and look at, you know, what's the full comprehension of how that religion is integral to somebody's life.
Yeah.
It was kind of an interesting point because they did keep bringing up religion again and again and again. You know, the grandmother sitting there reading the Bible out loud. Although I sit at his right hand or something when the robots turn off.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. And she wanted to go to a service and the robot stopped her from doing so.
Right.
That was just an interesting thing, mm-hmm. you know, little conflict there.
Right. So it was really a lot about the uniqueness of humanity versus artificial intelligence. And of course, the bad, bad big business.
Yeah, there's always that.
But the three laws, we didn't say what they were. It's you shall not harm a human being. A robot shall not harm a human being. Yeah, a robot shall not allow a human being to come to harm, whether through action or inaction or something like that. And then a robot shall protect itself. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's important to say, you know, a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. That's number one. I've got them here in front of me. I didn't memorize them. Number two
I'm disappointed. But yeah, okay.
A robot must obey the orders given to it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Got it. Okay.
And then number three is a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws.
Got it.
So the may not injure a human being is supposed to take precedence.
Right.
Yeah. And isn't it interesting that, you know, all of the robots that were hardwired with these three laws
mm-hmm.
were not very human-like. They were just robots, right?
Right.
And then you have the one that is able, it has the three laws, but it is able to decide to go against them. And that's the human-ish robot.
Right.
And I just think that that's an interesting point. You know, it goes into what you're saying there about emotion, but it's almost like it's a little bit more than that. It's almost as if, you know, in Catholicism, you know, we talk about free will and things, and how vital it is. It's got to be a piece of everything. Otherwise, our whole religion doesn't make any sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's my opinion anyway. I know that there are mm-hmm. some Christian sects that believe that we don't have free will, which just boggles my mind.
I don't get that, yes.
Yeah. So you've got all the robots that are just programmed, and then you've got the one that has the free will. And, mm-hmm. and to me, that was the difference between the two, is the one had the free will, and he was conflicted, asking, now he's going, well, what am I? You know?
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's just a little piece of, you know, exploring what it is to be human. You know, and in Star Trek again, you know, we have Data. There was several right. good Next Generation episodes. Yeah, and Mr. Spock too. Mr. Spock was really interesting that way.
Yeah.
But Data was always asking, well, what does it mean to be a person?
Right.
And one of the first really good Next Generation episodes was Data. There was a scientist that wanted to take apart Data because he wanted to figure out how he worked so he could make more. And he kept treating him like an object. And yeah. then they had to go to trial. Picard ended up being a lawyer. They went to went to a trial. Because Picard okay. can do anything. Right?
Right.
Except for beat up Captain Kirk, I guess.
Well, yeah, boy, that would be a tough one. He yeah. seems pretty fit, but he is older. Yeah.
That's right. But anyway, yeah. you know, he had to go to a court of law to prove his personhood. And that was a really, really good episode.
Oh, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, I think it's called The Measure of a Man.
Okay.
I just remember because I was like, oh, this is probably one of the first really good ones. But that's one of the things, you know, the robots versus the, in stories, you know, robots and Vulcans that are half human and everything like that. That's what they're doing in science fiction, is exploring humanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I enjoyed that aspect of it in this very much.
Yeah. And I would say, well, no, I don't want to say this. Star Trek has to be a separate conversation, I guess. Mm-hmm. There was a point I wanted to make about the new movie, but I'm not going to say it.
Okay.
Never mind. yeah, and I thought it was also interesting that even though these robots are not human, they've been given faces. They're very appealing, kind of like big eyes and that kind of thing. And that was one of the things that bothered Will Smith. He kept going, these are machines. Why do you give them human faces? Why do you make them look cute? And he's accused of being prejudiced.
Mm-hmm.
As yeah, if perhaps it you was don't another like race kind. Of people yeah, exactly. or something like that. Everybody, his boss uses the word. The guy who runs the big company uses the word. And I was like, well, that's interesting. They're talking as if he's a bigoted person.
Yeah.
As if they are real.
Right, right.
Whereas those robots aren't real. I mean, they really are machines, which is shown. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it was kind of an interesting extension.
It is. And another extension to me was their connectivity. And this movie was made, what do we say, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting right now how much people are worried about all this connectivity, mm-hmm. you know, with Microsoft reading Skype, you know, that was big news. You know, right. I don't even know if this is big. I haven't watched like the cable news for long, you know, since January, probably.
That's a good thing. I think.
It has made my life better.
Good.
And so anyway, you know, when you get your news off the internet, which, you know, I don't spend a lot of time doing, but when you do, you know, everyone gets all up in arms about Google, and, you know, Google's providing us this free service, but at the same time, what they're taking is the ability to show us advertising.
Right.
And that's how Google makes money. All of their free right. stuff is ways to get data so that they can show us better advertising.
Yeah.
And they make billions of dollars doing that. And so now you've got these robots, and they're all connected to this mothership or this brain, right?
Yeah.
And it's almost Google or Microsoft or something like that.
Well, yeah.
That's something that they may not have meant back then, but I think watching it now, you know, I made that connection anyway.
No, Well, it's funny for me, the connection that was made, and it's a similar point, although through a different route, is we just the night before we watched this, had watched a Doctor Who episode from season two where it was a two-parter, the Cybermen. I don't know if you've ever seen Doctor Who.
No.
But basically, they wind up on Earth in London, of course, because that's where everybody goes when they're space traveling. And unless it's Wales, because it's a Welsh show. But they wound up in 2024, and everybody has these two little earbuds, and they never take them out. I suppose maybe for sleeping. We didn't see that. And at one point, everybody in the street just stops dead in what they're doing. And Doctor Who and Rose are walking around going, what is going on? Oh, look, they're all downloading information.
Hmm.
It's everything. It's the news. It's the weather. It's the traffic reports. They're like, and a joke. And everybody laughs at the same time, and then they go on walking.
Oh, wow.
And so, right. And of course, we know what's going to happen. The minute we see that, we're like, oh, no, you didn't let yourselves get hooked into this. But of course, I immediately thought of how people never have, they always have an iPod, they're always connected to the internet, they never turn their computers off, and it used to be you'd worry about that with TV, but this is more insidious because it's coming right into your ears, and you could see how it could be an extension. And then we watched iRobot, and you would see them doing the same things to the robots.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something, a piece of technology that everybody let into their homes to become an integral part of their lives that they couldn't control. It was controlled from outside, from one source. And I thought, that's interesting how that's a continual source of worry in that, you know, you see it in movies and TV and stuff a lot, and in books,
mm-hmm.
because how much control do we give up? How much do we become dependent on things?
Yeah, well, almost since the first science fiction novel, you know, Frankenstein.
Right.
You know, it's almost like technology, you know, what are we doing as people, you know, shouldn't we be thinking about what we do in science, you know, that could be one of the themes of Frankenstein.
Right.
And I just looked this up. The first iPhone was released in 2007, which doesn't seem that long ago, does it?
No.
And it's absolutely, I mean, it's changed the world, hasn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. it really has. It's really interesting. And this movie was before that, and you could see the robots that are connected as people now.
Yeah, well, and I also, because thinking of those iPhones and how much they've changed the world, and that one of the things they've changed is they've made us stop looking at each other. You'll talk to somebody, and they're like, uh-huh, 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 and they're listening, but you're not looking into each other's eyes, and that's one of the primal ways we make connection with each other.
Yeah.
We look at screens increasingly.
For certain.
And yeah. I don't have an iPhone, but of course I do have a computer, and I'm just as guilty of that as anybody else. But I was reading an article on eye contact at The Art of Manliness, one of my favorite blogs, by the way, and they were talking about that very thing. And this all was the same kind of thing. It connects you less with people and less with each other.
Have you seen the
technology?
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. Have you seen the Google Glass?
Yes. And it's both fascinating and creeps me out.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel the same way about it. Both. Exactly. It's like, you know, hey, that would be nifty, but what's that going to do to everybody? You know? And, it's interesting. I wonder what's going to happen from here. It doesn't seem that far away, does it, that we'll have something like a brain pal, which is what one of Scalzi's, I think that's what Scalzi called it, John Scalzi.
Okay.
A brain pal being basically a connection to the internet that's, you know, in your head so that, you know, you don't have to carry a device anymore. You just have a brain pal.
Yeah, I don't even, heavens to Betsy. Well, and that at that point I'll be considered, oh mother, you know, such a codgerish person.
Yeah.
For thinking that's a bad idea. Well, and it's funny because we just last night watched 12 Angry Men.
Oh.
Which I've seen. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have. You're talking about the older one? I don't know.
Yeah.
Did they remake it? I think they did. Yeah, but the one that I liked was the black and white one.
But it was one of those movies that, you know, you've seen the jokes, you've seen the references, but I'd never seen the actual movie. And so I said, well, okay. And that movie was all about not taking what's just handed to you, but using your own brain to think it through. It was about a lot of other things, too. And it was really surprisingly excellent. I recommend it to anyone who hasn't seen it. But one of the things they were doing is the DA for this kid was kind of just going through the motions, it seemed like. So one person starts thinking about it more. What were the questions he had that never got asked or answered? And that's what starts the 12 angry men off on really looking deeper. And that's the whole thing of, do you just accept what's given to you? Do you evaluate it in your own life? That's what Will Smith is mad about. Mm-hmm. Everyone just goes, yay, free robots or whatever. Or do you think about it? And he hasn't really thought it through because he can't articulate it well. He just knows something isn't right about it. And he says, a human being would have known that 11% would have been enough to save that little girl.
Right.
They would have saved the younger person, not the grown man.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, I think that that may be the key to why we, you know, I'm assuming you as well, but we all kind of feel that way about technology. It's like, okay, there's something's going wrong here, but we can't quite articulate what, you know, in the world. And the fact that I think that the result is that less people are thinking things through, and all this connectivity makes, you know, tidal waves or whatever. That's just the way I can see it in my head, where an opinion can become a fact to a whole lot of people.
Right.
When there's nothing but an opinion.
Well, and it's one of those things where I don't know if it's, we like to act like it's a new thing that people aren't thinking things through, but I think, without trying to sound elitist, and I'm not at all, but I'm thinking about that movie again, 12 Angry Men. There was one man who was a little more curious than the others, who was thinking about the person on trial as not a stereotype, or he's keeping me from my ball game, or I'm more interested in something else. He was just like, well, if I was this kid and had this background, I'd want to know these questions answered. And no one ever did it. So that was back then without the other stuff. Everybody else, though, was willing just to take what they were handed and walk in and go, well, we could see he's guilty. Let's move on. And it's when you start delving into the reasons, and it was surprisingly compelling. But it's that same thing that you're saying is, but I think there have always been people who are willing to just take what's handed to them, whether it's the town crier saying it or whoever.
Yeah, that makes
but
sense.
When you're more connected to people, you're forced to talk about it a little more, or think about it a little more, I think, than when it's just handed to everyone as easily. And I could be wrong or confused.
No,
or
I don't.
Making the same point you just made. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. Maybe it's just easier to see
now.
Yeah, maybe that's really what it is.
But we are kind of, we are all kind of, I guess the fact that we're kind of afraid of it, and these movies talk about it, is a good thing. It kind of keeps us aware of the potential for Big Brother out there.
Right. Yeah, I think 1984 is, it doesn't seem to have prevented anything, does it though? You know, but 1984, it's kind of the poster child or whatever for thinking about this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like warning, you know.
Right.
And
right.
You know, it was written so long ago, and yet we're just kind of walked right into it anyway.
Well, that and Fahrenheit 451, which we've also walked right into. I mean, you could have a TV that's as big as your wall, and I can imagine soon you'd be able to, you know, be part of the game they're playing or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just kind of interesting to think about. I think it's that idea of wanting to hang on to your humanity. What is it that makes us different, and what is it that makes us not just settle?
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, this movie, actually, that's where I was surprised that this movie did it justice. You know, those ideas, even though it was an action movie.
Yeah.
It wasn't just Skynet, which was the essence of the idea. You know, oh, they're being controlled. And, you know, the machines haven't yet gotten to the point that they have in The Terminator, where they're trying to take you out because they're going to run things for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what's really safest? If you guys aren't here. then we know you're safe.
We know you're safe, yeah.
but because of Asimov's laws, you know, we'll just shut you in a room and let you sit because that is it. But I don't know. It's kind of interesting to me also when you look at there's so many science – well, not – okay, technically not science fiction. I get that. But science fiction's placed movies that have just come out and are coming out this summer.
Yeah.
So many. I saw the previews and I went, oh, I forgot.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And some I hadn't heard of. And I thought, I wonder, is this a reaction? Some of it's a reaction, as you see in one movie in particular I can think of, is to terrorism.
Oh, yeah.
But others are, they look like it's a worry about technology and how fast things are changing. Because, you know, that's what science fiction and those settings are allowed to reflect much more easily than a lot of other things, is the worries that we have and the concerns that how do we deal with these things in our own lives.
Right.
And I think these movies, in a very superficial way, a lot of the time, that's what they're dealing with.
Yeah. Have you seen that there's a little movement in science fiction now, in written science fiction? Where some people have gotten together and have said, you know, we have gotten so dismal and depressing and dystopian that, you know, boy, we need to be writing some optimistic stuff.
Oh,
and there's a little group that's come together, and Neal Stephenson is in this group. Has basically said, you know, come on, let's project a positive future and let's try and get there.
Well, that's good, because that's one of the things I find so refreshing about the older science fiction and the older – you go look at the old Star Trek, the very first Star Trek, very hopeful.
Yeah, and, you know, and Next Generation was that way too.
Yeah.
I felt anyway, because that was part of the appeal of it, was that it was so optimistic, and you could say, you know, there were problems in the future, but they weren't problems among ourselves anymore. I mean, it was almost like that they had all of this stuff, the petty things that we're dealing with, seem to have gone away in the future, which gave us something to strive for. And I think that was part of the appeal of Star Trek in the first place.
A sense of hope and optimism. Well, and I think that was the case with a lot of stuff, although you did have people writing things like, what is it, Make Room, Make Room.
Oh, sure.
Which is the basis for Soylent Green. So at the same time as you had the Planet of the Apes and Soylent Green and the Omega Man, Charlton Heston, we love you. but you had also, you had Star Trek, and you had more optimistic things going on. So yeah, there's not that balance. And I was listening to Movie Date, which is my favorite movie podcast. And they were pointing out that the science fiction movies have all gotten really dark. Like the new Superman. Superman was always about, you know, he's an all-American. He's saving us from these crazy villains. And now it's the dark side of Superman. Star Trek Into Darkness. These things where they said they think the theme started with Christopher Nolan, at least for superheroes, that, you know, it's got to be dark and gloomy and we've got to think it through. And, you know, Batman is one thing. I understand they say he was always that way.
Yeah.
A little angsty. But the other superheroes, it hadn't occurred to me. They were always about hope and the American way, which in this case, for anybody who's not American, just equates with hope and cheerfulness and getting things done for everyone in a wonderful way and that kind of thing. And now I thought, wow, where do we get that? Because that's what somebody liked about Iron Man 3. They said it was full of, imbued with that sense of hope for the future. I don't know. I haven't seen it.
That's an interesting take on that. I didn't get that from Iron Man 3.
Okay. One person hadn't seen it, and the other person went, they saw at least glimmers of it.
Yeah, maybe.
But I'm glad to hear about the movement, because it is, where is the hope? And it's like we all sit around and just whine all the time.
Right.
Oh, things are awful. Oh.
If this keeps going, we're going to be toast.
Yeah, no, we just sit there and cry a lot.
Right, right.
And that's, some of that's okay. You got to have some introspection. But in a sense, that was one good thing about iRobot. I mean, you know, I liked iRobot okay. It's not, you know, your best movie ever made, but it was a summer blockbuster type movie.
Sure.
So that's what it was. Mm-hmm. But it, you didn't feel like everybody was beat down.
Yeah.
I mean, Will Smith was angry, but that was his thing. But everybody else was, woo, I got my new robot. Excellent. Better living through technology.
Yeah. Heck yeah. Yeah, and this you know, Harlan Ellison script, you know, that would have been kind of an interesting movie. It really would have been. And you know, Susan Calvin was at the center of it. So the way that it worked is that there's a reporter who goes to a funeral for this guy named Stephen Byerly. Mm-hmm. And Susan Calvin was at the funeral, and apparently Susan Calvin has disappeared from view for a long time. So, you know, he's kind of a tabloid reporter type, and is very excited that Susan Calvin's there. So he tries to get in there to talk to her. Anyway, he ends up, the whole thing ends up being Susan Calvin's whole life told through by this reporter. And, you know, while at the same time he's trying to reach her, so that he can interview her, which she hasn't granted for, you know, a good long time. But I don't know if I can do this real spoiler, because I thought that this was really interesting. You know, I say spoiler for a movie that's never been made, but there's
you're going to read the script.
Yeah, one of the things that the person that was being buried at the beginning of the script, he was like the president of the universe or whatever.
Wasn't he from the last story that was written where the question was whether he was a robot or
not? Exactly. That's exactly right. So, you know, so he's buried at, or actually, I forget what they called it, you know, instead of being incinerated, he was like reduced to atoms or whatever and put in a container. But anyway, so she reveals near the end that he was a robot to this reporter. She says, well, he was a robot. And that was the nature of my relationship to him, was that he was a robot and I made him, right? And he ended up being the president of everything and all that stuff. So just listen to this little scene. At this point, he's named Lenny. And Lenny is a robot like Sonny was. So Sonny, you know, he's got a little extra. There's something going on with him that wasn't going on with all the robots. And Lenny says, there's something wrong and I have to find out what it is. And Susan says, wrong? What's wrong? We live very well. And Lenny says, the war, Susan. There's something out there helping to keep the war going. I don't know what it is. But I've run extrapolations on the news reports, on the calculus of the battle. It isn't being generated by humans. And Susan says, what are you talking about? And Lenny says, I'm not sure. But I have to go out in the world to find out. I have to be a human being to track it down. Can you? Will you help me? And anyway, that immediately thought of messianic, you know, kind of a, you know, sending a messiah into the world. You know, this person or this robot being turned into a human to go into the world to save it, which is what she was doing. Yeah. So
interesting.
Yeah, but there was a lot of... It was a good script. Too bad it didn't get made.
Pick it up, someone. Do we know anyone who's got connections? Come on, this is the time you could do it.
That would be great. That would be great. I wonder if they'll make... You know, they are poised. They could make a sequel of this. To, you know, if they... I don't know. Will Smith would obviously have to be interested, but they could do The Caves of Steel. Except for there's really no Caves of Steel.
Well,
their cities aren't covered in domes.
Yeah.
But to pair him with a robot,
that would be really
interesting. That would be pretty cool. Yeah, R. Daniel Oliva.
You need to send him a send him something, some kind of a come on, you could do it. Although Rose says that she's read that he's not going to do movies that aren't family friendly, so he just has to reduce the shooting.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't any sex in this. There was just shooting.
No, yeah.
And it was just robots, really. Oh, except for the guy who smashed on the floor. But other than that, well, two things I wanted to say, although I guess we've talked about stuff that's Catholic, but these aren't necessarily Catholic. But I really liked two things about this movie. One is, I mean, that just struck me that I wrote them down. Sonny is so human, he gets his own action sequence. He is running down the corridor, and he's coming up against the bad M5s, trying to stop him with the nanites, you know. And he's got his own, so he is the focus of the secondary action scene. That's using to provide tension going back and forth. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's brilliant to me. And then the other thing was, when are you going to build a parking garage like the one I saw at the beginning of this?
Hey, it's Tom coming says, right up. That's the plan.
Tom says they have to have cars that don't have oil and gas. But so, but I went, okay. Oh, is that what Scott's building? That's pretty cool looking.
There you go. Yep. Yeah. All our cars stay horizontal, hopefully. That's
you have to have a up and down little slot to slide.
There you
into,
go. Heck yes, yeah.
Instead of the up. End up and end. I thought, but I went, oh, that's why Scott picked it.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah, that one. And then there's a really cool garage in Mission Impossible 3.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Also made me think of you.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool one. That would be neat.
Yeah.
I assume that one does not exist either, but
I don't know.
It sure could. There's no reason why that one couldn't.
Yeah, that's Tom was wondering if it did, actually.
Yeah, it might. It might.
Because he's like, oh, that'd be like something. Those weren't they in a Middle Eastern rich like Dubai?
Yeah, Dubai. Well, yeah.
Like that's like something those rich Arabs would have.
Oh yeah, no question.
The top level.
Money is no object. Let's build cool stuff.
He goes, "Those." I understand Dubai is an amazing city. So
yeah, it's got to be. Yeah. I know in Dubai they have an indoor ski slope in the middle of the desert. They have a
wow.
Yeah, they make it snow in there. You know,
okay,
really
so
snow.
See, that parking garage is nothing.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, definitely.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah.
So.
Well, good. All right.
Yeah.
Well, that was fun. I did. Thanks for watching this movie. It was fun.
No, it was fun. I enjoyed it. And I was just surprised I hadn't seen it again. And then I was surprised at how smart on one level it hit me and then how dumb on another level.
Yeah, it's like on the individual lines and things. You're like, oh,
yeah.
Yeah, little eye rolling, but. But still, you know, I was glad to see that Asimov was in there. And that's one of the things, when I came out of this movie the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, there he is. Right. And I'm glad that they did that. But at the same time, disappointed that a real smart movie wasn't made. You know, why not? Why not make, you know, it doesn't have to be Ellison's script, but why can't we have that? And the reason is
because
it wouldn't make
Inception.
Billions of dollars. Yeah.
That made so much money and it was very smart.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, you didn't have to understand it on every single level if you didn't want to.
Right.
But it rewards multiple rewatchings and that kind of thing. So I think that's why I was kind of, I was disappointed with Star Trek on two or three fronts, but like, which is makes it funny that I'm like, oh, definitely go watch it anyway.
Well, how can you not? It's just like, you know, I don't know. Star Trek is one of those things. If they make it, I will see it. You know, even those series, I tried Voyager until I couldn't stand it any longer and I didn't watch it. And then Enterprise, I mean, I wanted
that the other one.
Yeah, I wanted that to win so bad. I mean, I watched that off and on the entire time it was on.
Oh, and,
but it was never really great.
I think I watched two or three seasons of it.
Yeah. I think there were only four.
Okay, well, then I watched two seasons of it, I guess, where I finally was like, okay, I've seen this 1,000 times.
Yeah.
So, well, speaking of, let me just really quickly say, speaking of things that are depressing and dystopic, or I have read just now a couple of books that handle the end of the world in such an interesting, smart way. That even though I can't read them right before bed or I have very depressing dreams, they're really good. And they're called The Last Detective and then Countdown City. It's a planned trilogy. And the Countdown City, I think, has not been released or has just been released. I got it through Amazon Vine.
Okay.
And they're by Ben H. Winters. And the premise is similar to Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, which is that an asteroid's going to hit the Earth and nothing can stop it, and it's the dinosaur killer, basically. Except for the fact that it's so big that it's going to smush a lot of the Earth, and anybody who's left alive is going to suffer miserably from no food and cold and polluted water and whatever else awful they can think of for a short time and then die. So it starts off with the detective, a homicide detective, and there are a lot of suicides from people who don't want to put up with this horrible end that he thinks doesn't feel right. And so he's going to investigate. And everyone keeps saying, why are you investigating a murder when we're all going to die in 6 months anyway? And he just keeps going. And then Countdown City is the sequel to that. And so at the same time as he's investigating different things, you see society starting to break down. And the interesting thing is, although some of society is breaking down and people are running away and going bucket list, as they call it, other people are going, oh, it's my chance to be a doctor. I was so close, and now they need somebody who's got at least the basic skills, and they're like, this is my bucket list. And so some people are being elevated because their desire was to do something better and nobler.
Wow, that's cool.
It's a very, it's an interesting book or set of books.
Okay. So, yeah, I saw that come through on Goodreads.
Yeah.
You and recommended it to me.
Neat. And they're not hopeful because it's the end of the world. But they are interesting in terms of dealing with what am I doing with my own life? What's my, you know, we're all going, we've all got that big exit. It's just, is it at one time or not? So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, very. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I just finished a book called The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak. And man, I thought it was fantastic. I finished it last night.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it was really something else. It's a World War II era in Germany. It's about a young girl is the protagonist. Her name is Liesl. Mm-hmm. And she's got a pretty tough life there in Germany. And she's not Jewish, but they end up, you know, harboring a Jewish person in their basement for a while.
Okay.
And but anyway, the whole style of it, the book is narrated by Death. So at the very beginning, you know, Death is the one that's speaking. And so the style of the book is just neat. It's really, really something.
I've seen that mentioned by a lot of people. And I think Rose recommended it to me, saying that she found it refreshing to read a book about World War II where the protagonist wasn't under direct persecution by Nazis. Mm-hmm. She's like, there had to be other people.
Right, right.
Thank you for writing about one of them. But she also liked the book a lot, too. Yep, so you're the second one. So
yeah, and this may be a pick in the future for me. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. And I like the idea.
So you could wait till I toss it out there if you want.
Yeah, well, then I will. Plenty more books. And yeah. I just want to say, for my birthday, Tom bought me an Audible subscription for a year.
Oh, way to go, Tom. That's awesome.
I'm so excited because I love all the stuff I get via SFF audio or other free stuff. But, you know, there are all these other things out there where I'm like, oh, I can't listen to that. Mm-hmm. So this is very exciting.
Oh,
it's too
great.
Many choices. I can't choose what I'm going to listen to.
Yeah, it's a tough deal. All right. Good problem to have.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, that's great. Well, happy birthday to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, so what do we got coming up? The Demolished Man, more science fiction.
Yeah.
Yes, The Demolished Man by Alfred Bester.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to that. Hope there's plenty in there to talk about. I think that there will be. It's one of those things that I picked. I'm saying, that would be fun to talk about. And then,
I hope.
Usually there's stuff, so it'll be fun.
Well, we certainly managed with iRobot, and it was a relatively thin movie.
It was,
you know what I'm saying.
Oh, sure, you bet.
I enjoyed it. Don't get me wrong. And then I picked the movie, going also with the summer movie theme, but going a little further back.
Right.
And this is classically, I'm going to say again, classically American. It's a Western, and it's an ensemble film, The Magnificent Seven.
All right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That's although I guess
great.
It's not classically American. It's been made classically American because the Seven Samurai, but, let's get real.
Heck yeah.
This is just amazing movie.
Great.
And then I picked the book, but I can't remember what I picked. The Case of the Missing Servant.
That's it. Yep.
By Tarquid Hall. I don't know if that's how you say his name. Tarquid or Tarquid Hall.
Cool.
Yeah, so, yeah, a mystery current day set in India with a detective.
Right. And I found it on Paperback Swap. And I'm just looking in there right now to see. Yep, there's more of them. So.
Ah, yep. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Because so, I think I'd like my own copy.
Good. Yep, The Case of the Missing Servant by Tarquin Hall. Vish Puri, Book 1.
Tarquin Hall. Yeah.
Yeah. Tarquin Hall.
Yeah, this is also something that struck me as a summertime book, you know, uh-huh. reading mysteries, easy reads. And it's so interesting because it takes you inside his family life also. So you see what it's like in India. So that's the tourist part.
Oh, that's cool.
So
fantastic. Yep, looking forward to it.
Yeah.
So good. All right. Well, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah,
always have a good time.
Yes, definitely. And this was a good start to the summer.
Heck yeah. Great. And thanks, everybody, for listening. So
yes.
Join us again in a couple of weeks for The Demolished Man by Alfred Bester.
Mm-hmm. See you in a couple of weeks, everybody.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.